This is Audible.
Sounds True presents The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles by Dr. Bruce Lipton, an internationally recognized authority in bridging science and spirit. And now, The Biology of Belief.
I truly appreciate that you are taking this opportunity to listen to this presentation on the biology of belief. I think you will find this information not only illuminating and exciting, but also very empowering. For this is a new biology that we're going to discuss, a biology not based on genes controlling life, but on perceptions controlling life, meaning that how you see life is actually how your biology will respond. To lead into this understanding of the science, I think we should really go back to before science. Because before there was the actual field of science, there were people with ideas that gave us information as to how the universe might work. These people were philosophers. Science is based on philosophy. First, a philosopher would offer an idea of the mechanisms of the universe, and then science would try to see if those ideas actually are real in the world that we live in. So science is actually a proof of philosophy. So therefore, to understand the nature of the science that we live with today, it is really incumbent upon us to go back and understand the philosophical roots that have led to today's world of modern science. Science is actually formulated on philosophies that were created during the Golden Age of Greece. There were two fundamental philosophers that gave us opinions and views of how the world actually worked. One of them was a man by the name of Democritus. Democritus is famous for providing us with the concept of atoms. He coined the word atom as something being uncuttable, meaning the smallest particle in the universe. He said that there are all different kinds of atoms with all different kinds of characteristics. And if you want to understand anything about the world we live in, then you have to look at the physical things that we observe and see what kind of atoms they're made out of, because the atoms would give character to all the physical structure. According to this philosophy of atomism, the world is composed of these physical particles called atoms, and there's nothing in between the atoms. That there are physical things and then empty space. So according to the atomists, if you really want to understand the world, just focus on the material existence. In regard to movement, this is what Democritus suggested. He said that actions such as life result from atoms hitting each other in much the same way that a billiard ball will hit another ball and then careen off and yet hit another ball, setting all the balls into action, that the balls being the atoms would start moving. So that, according to Democritus, life is comprised of uncuttable little pieces of structure called atoms, and that movement is a result of atoms colliding with each other. While Democritus was presenting us with a materialistic view of the world, another very prominent philosopher was also giving us ideas. This man was Socrates. Socrates looked at the world, but he saw a duality. He said there are actually two components that comprise the universe. He called one component a vitalistic component, a component based on energy. He said that this vitalistic force represents a form or spirit, that there are shapes and energy before there are actual expressions of matter. According to Socrates, this form of energy is a perfect or ideal form. So he talked about the vitalistic sphere of the universe, the energy form, as being perfect, as compared to the materialistic or physical expression. So, for example, Socrates would suggest that the world of form can have something such as a perfect circle. But then if I give you a pencil and say, okay, I can imagine a perfect circle, but let me see you draw a perfect circle, this is where it falls apart. When the ideas are then created into actual structure, we lose some of that perfect character. So according to Socrates, there are two expressions in the universe: the perfect, ideal, vitalistic form, and then the physical reality, which is an approximation, but never as perfect as the real form. So we have a vitalistic and materialistic component. When the age of Greece passed, and the origin of Christianity started to take over the minds of people in Western civilization, science was also brought into the church. However, in the science of the church, it had to depend on which of the philosophies was going to be followed, that of Democritus or that of Socrates. As you realize, the church ultimately selected Socrates' concept of the world, that there was an invisible vitalistic spiritual component as well as a physical component. The church, like Socrates, also suggested that the physical component, the one that we live in, the physical world that we experience, is just a crude shadow of really what is the perfect or ideal world. And in fact, this is the teaching of the church, is to not actually be caught up in this crude world that we live in, but to look forward to getting into the more perfect world of spirit and energy. And this is the foundational belief that the church brought in from the philosophy of Greece. However, while the church was really preoccupied with spiritual issues, it became the teacher of the Western civilization, and that the church ran all the schools. And so in the schools, they taught a science. The science that the church taught was actually a composition of information from the Greek philosophers mixed with spiritual teachings. So in fact, it was based on the work of Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas to provide us with a mixing of Christian spiritual understandings with Greek philosophical understandings, as well as the Greek science provided by Aristotle. So Christian science was actually a mixture of Socrates, Aristotle, and spiritual traditions. When Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas penned this new science, it was called natural theology. The mission statement of scientists that were teaching natural theology was to gain an understanding of the natural order so that we could live in harmony with it. This is actually a pretty wonderful mission statement. I wish we were using this mission statement today, because it really suggested that if you understand the natural order of the universe and understand the physical part of the universe, that we would actually be able to live in harmony with that universe. The scientists that were practicing natural theology were primarily catalogers. They went through the world and identified things, giving names to animals and plants and all different kinds of species. However, much of the science was not really open to investigation. And the reason for that is the church claimed that it possessed infallible knowledge, meaning that whatever it said existed that way because it was really directly from God. This information was not questionable. So scientists were actually restricted in their efforts, because if they started to find information that was really not supported by the church, that would go against the infallible character that the church was claiming. So scientists were actually more or less just repeating the dogma that was provided in this natural theology. In fact, much of the universe was actually off limits to scientists, because the church considered some areas of life in the universe as mysteries of God and not really amenable for people to look at or for people to understand how they work. For example, the operation of the human body was referred to as a mystery of God. As a result of that classification, people were really not allowed to look inside the human body to see what was in there or how it worked. It was off limits. In fact, it was a sin for a Christian to look inside the human body. Interestingly, because of that, there were no Christian medical doctors. At the time, the only doctors were Muslims and Jews, because they were not restricted in their efforts of looking inside at the anatomy and function of the human body. However, as scientists started to expand and start to look at the world, of course they started to infringe upon the infallible beliefs of the church with different pieces of knowledge. Whenever a scientist did show up with something that differed from the church, these scientists were referred to as heretics, and that they actually had to be tried at a court called the Inquisition. The Inquisition would actually be a kangaroo court, because nobody could beat the Inquisition court, meaning this: if you claimed you had knowledge different from the church, and the church claimed it had infallible knowledge, those two would not jive together. So the only way the church can maintain infallible knowledge is to eliminate any dissenting opinion. And this was the role of the Inquisition, that when people would come up with differing ideas on how the universe worked, the Inquisition would force them to recant or punish them. Even burning them at the stake was an option for people who would not recant their heretical beliefs. Well, this was a very interesting situation for an astronomer priest by the name of Nicholas Copernicus, because during his career while teaching at the university and doing his research on astronomy, Copernicus found out that the Earth was not the center of the universe as it was suggested in natural theology. So while the church was claiming infallible knowledge and put the Earth in the center of God's domain, Copernicus started to realize that this was not true, that the Earth revolved around the sun, that the sun itself wasn't even the center of the universe. And now he was in a bind, because while he had the scientific evidence to reveal that the Earth was not the center of the universe, that the church was indeed fallible, he was smart enough to realize that by providing this information to the public, he would end up in the Inquisition court himself and then suffer either the punishment or the requirement to recant his heretical views. Copernicus is really a smart guy, though. What he did is he waited until his deathbed in 1543. And as he was dying, he released to the public his book on the nature of the solar system and the movement of the Earth around the sun. And it was interesting because what he was actually saying to the church was, listen, I'm out of here, but you're going to have to deal with this science because I'm leaving that behind. And this put the church in a very awkward position because without anybody to persecute, then they were stuck with the reality of the science that Copernicus offered. And as a result of that, the science revealed that the church was indeed fallible. And when the church was fallible, it meant that it was also open then to question, that scientists could then further question to find out what other fallible things has the church required or what other fallible things has the church offered us that may be different if we understand them. As a result of this ability to ask questions about the universe without the restriction of the church, this represented the birth of modern science. So in fact, the deathbed date of Nicholas Copernicus, 1543, is marked as the beginning of the scientific revolution. While science came in, it decided it did not want to offer truth the way the church did, just based on opinion and information that was passed from generation to generation. Science was really trying to say, what is a truth? We have no idea what a truth is. In fact, one of the early philosopher scientists of the day, René Descartes, suggested that we throw out all knowledge because he said whatever knowledge we brought forward to this time, no one knows whether it's really true or not, or whether it was just hearsay that was passed on. As a result, throwing out the knowledge said we must provide new truths for the world that we live in. To prevent the kind of truths that sneak through in regard to the religious education, science provided what was called analytical science. Analytical science was based on observing the phenomena of the world, then actually recording all the observations, and then coming up with ideas or hypotheses of how the phenomena that we observe actually occur, and then creating experiments to test those hypotheses. When the hypotheses were correct, things were predictable. If the hypotheses were incorrect, then, of course, they were not predictable. That would lead the scientists to readjust the hypothesis, trying to get a more accurate sense of the truth, all based on predictability. Well, as the church's control over knowledge fell and scientists started to appear, of course, scientists also entertained the philosophy of how the universe works. Some of the scientists were followers of Socrates that believed in an energy world of vitalism behind the expression of life. And then again, there were other scientists who were actually followers of Democritus, who believed that atoms were the central structure of the universe. These people were atomists as compared to the others who were vitalists. The atomists perceived the universe as a physical machine derived from these atoms, the atoms being the smallest parts of the world, each with different characters. And so by understanding the nature of any physical structure and the atoms that comprise it, we would get insight into the character of that structure and the reasons for the actions and reactions provided by it. As a result, scientists started to try to understand the world with these two different divergent philosophies. One of the most prominent scientists to actually shape modern science was Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was an atomist in this regard because he looked at the world and the universe as a machine. He looked at the movements of the planets and the stars in the skies and suggested that their clockwork actions actually reflected a physical mechanism. In trying to understand the movements of the system, Isaac Newton came up with a new kind of mathematics called differential calculus. And into those mathematical equations, he put the physical characters of the things he was studying, the planets, or for example, the moon. And in the equation, he put the mass of a planet. He put the direction of the movement of the planet. He put the character of gravity, which is a reflection of the size or mass of the planet, and as well the acceleration of the planet. When he started to resolve these equations, he found that he was able to accurately predict the movement of the bodies in the universe. The significance of this predictability revealed that he fully had a truthful understanding of what was going on in this universe, because predictability is the hallmark of a scientific truth. When he got finished, science took a different view of the world. The vitalists started to recede and decline in numbers. The atomists started to take over the field of science, starting to look at the world as a physical machine. And it was interesting because with a mission statement of modern science, formerly being the mission statement of natural theology, where we were trying to learn to live in harmony with the planet, the new mission statement of science in this mechanistic material world completely changed. For the reason is, if we do perceive the universe as a machine, then it is also very reasonable and logical to recognize that if you take this machine apart and look at its pieces, its atoms, its molecules, and its structure, that you would actually get an understanding of how the machine worked. And with this understanding of the machine and how it works, you'd also be able to influence the operation of the machine and the outcome of the machine. So as a result, post-Isaac Newton, the mission of modern science changed to this. It was now designed to obtain knowledge that can be used to dominate and control nature. And this was the expectation, that if we lived in a physical world and we knew actually how the physical parts interacted, we could control that world, including humans, because humans, as part of the machine, would also represent a mechanical device. And knowledge of the mechanics of the human would lead to an understanding of how to control human life. For over 200 years after Isaac Newton's original work, scientists kept repeating Isaac Newton's work and looking at his equations and using them to define the operation of the universe. About 200 years later, by the end of the 1800s, around actually 1893, a number of eminent and prominent physicists came to the conclusion that Isaac Newton's equations did describe the universe, that there was nothing new to learn, that after this point, we actually don't even need any more PhDs in physics, because all the rest of physics is just going to use the same equations of Isaac Newton with finer and finer measurements and finer solutions to how the universe operated. So to me, it was a very funny and interesting time, because it represents something that I call a cosmic joke. To me, a cosmic joke is when you think you actually know something so well that you would actually bet your life, bet your family farm, even throw the kitchen sink into that bet because you know for sure the outcome. And all of a sudden you make the bet, and then right in front of your eyes, the answer is something completely different. You're so shocked that you can't even understand, how could I miss that? To me, that's a cosmic joke. Well, this is a great cosmic joke, because here are the physicists actually saying it's the end of physics. We already know everything about the universe. And this is in 1893. And then the universe throws them a big curveball, because in 2 years, new information about atoms starts manifesting. Rentgen discovers X-rays, that energy rays that can actually pass through matter. The Curies come up with an understanding of radioactivity, that atoms release energy and change themselves into different kinds of isotopes, that the permanence and final uncuttable nature of atoms was now in question. There appeared to be something within atoms. Atoms were not the smallest piece of the universe. And as a result, science started to look for something different. In 1905, Albert Einstein comes up with a solution to explain these mystery energies associated with atoms. In his equation, where he writes E equals mc square, he's talking about the fact that energy and mass are interrelated to one another. What he actually found, and it was supported by Planck and Heisenberg and other leaders of the field to be called quantum mechanics, is that the atom was indeed not the smallest part of the universe, that inside the atom there were other structures. But as they looked inside the atom, they found that rather than physical things that we thought were in there, such as electrons and protons and neutrons, there were nothing physical inside the atom. The atom was actually small vortices of energy spinning around, that energies in the atom would come and go. Sometimes they were there and sometimes they were not there. This surprising, weird world of physics revealed something that was so profound that even the physicists had a hard time conceptualizing it. The reality is this. If I give you a camera load it with film, and can shrink you to the size of an atom, and ask you to fly through an atom, and take pictures as you fly from one side of the atom through the atom and out the other side. When you come back from this trip and we start to develop the film and look at the pictures, what you will see is there was nothing in there, that there are no physical components inside the atom. The atom itself is made out of energy. And the relevance about that is that all of a sudden it says our whole emphasis on the nature of the universe being a physical world may be wrong. If atoms are made out of energy, and atoms make molecules, then by nature molecules are made out of energy. And if molecules give rise to cells, then cells are made out of energy. And if cells create humans, then humans are made out of energy as well. And all of a sudden, our surety of a world based on matter starts to dissolve, because in the world of quantum physics, we realize that the universe is actually an energy universe, completely opposite of the opinion held by Newtonian physicists that perceived of the universe as a physical machine. Well, was quantum mechanics right? Did they really have an understanding of what was going on? The most amazing thing is, for sure it did. Within 20 years of the time that quantum mechanics was introduced into the world of physics and accepted by the physicists of the day as the mechanisms that provide for the world, within that 20-year period, we created the atom bomb. And that was all based on the theories of quantum physicists, so that that theory actually became material in the expression of that bomb. We opened up into the atomic age. This cosmic joke that led us from a mechanical world into an energy world provided us with miraculous advances in our technology. We went from crank phones to cell phones. We went from stethoscopes to CAT scans. We went from typewriters and bottles of whiteout to laptops. All of this new technology derived from the theories based in quantum mechanics. It is now recognized that the theories of quantum mechanics are the most absolutely proven theories in all of science, so that all of a sudden we really must own the reality of this new world, a world based on energy, not on matter. Through the rest of this presentation, I'm going to focus on a new cosmic joke, a joke that is unfolding in biology right now. The consequences of this cosmic joke will have even more profound impact on human society than the acceptance of quantum mechanics. Because this new cosmic joke reveals something about ourselves as living organisms, how we relate to the environment, and how we relate to life. And why this becomes important for us is because it's knowledge of self. Remember, knowledge is power. Consequently, self-knowledge is self-empowerment. So, to set up this cosmic joke that is unfolding right now, I need to do a little backtracking and go back to the beginning of biology and start from there. It was less than 100 years after Isaac Newton established the formality of the science of physics, and then biology was created as its own individual formal science. However, biologists used the physics of Newton to understand the nature of biology. So the very first understanding is that all living things, such as the human body, represent physical machines. And according to the principles of the atomists and Newtonian physicists, it was understood that if you take this machine apart and see all the pieces and how they interact, you would understand how it works. And exactly this was the mission statement of science anyway. Remember, to dominate and control nature. So the nature of biologists was to follow through in that mission statement. However, before you can dominate and control nature, and although you see living organisms as machines, a very big understanding had to be found first. And that understanding is, what is it that actually controls the mechanism? Because if you want to control and dominate life, you have to identify where the natural control mechanism is in a living organism, and then that's what you would manipulate to alter the outcome of the living system. At the early days, René Descartes provided us with a concept that there's a mind and a body. And while some people, the vitalists especially, thought that the mind might be the energy, that soul or form that was in some sense controlling the physical body, physicists didn't agree with that. They considered the mind as an epiphenomenon, something that derives from the operation of the physical machine. But the mind itself was energy. And as energy in a physical world, it would not impact matter. That was a given in the rules of atomists, that matter can only affect matter. Since the mind is not matter, then the mind in no way can influence the life of the body in which it resides. So consequently, biologists let go of the influence of the mind on human biology. Even to this very day, it has been very difficult for scientists to incorporate the concept of a mind in the operation of living organisms. Biologists instead wanted to go into the matter of biology, looking at the physical things, because somewhere in that physical mechanism, there's a physical thing that actually represents the control. Nobody actually had an idea of what were the physical elements in the physical body that provided for this control. Around 1859, when Darwin released his theory of evolution on the origin of species, he included in there a discussion based on the fact that the organisms in our world carry traits, but the traits of an organism are related to the traits of the parents. And in that time in our history, many, many people were raising plants and animals, animal husbandry, all kinds of new agriculture was evolving, and people were very much involved with breeding plants and animals. So when Charles Darwin came up with the notion that the traits of an individual are controlled by the parents, then it became obvious that whatever is controlling the traits of a person, for example, must have been provided to them via the germ cells, because that was the physical thing that the parents provided that gave rise to the new offspring. So basically, it was suggested that somewhere in the germ cells, there's going to be some physical component that would end up controlling the traits of an individual. Well, the study of what was in the germ cells started in real intense effort right after Charles Darwin. However, it was around 1892 when August Weismann, a German scientist studying isolated cells, started to see structures that appeared just before the cell divided. These structures were called chromosomes, little thread-like structures that were found in the middle of the cell. And that as you watched the cell, the thread-like chromosomes were split into two groups, and each of the daughter cells received a complete set of these chromosomes. It was suggested by Weismann and then by others carrying out this research that indeed these little units, the chromosomes, represented the physical units of heredity. However, when scientists were able to isolate the chromosomes, they found they were comprised of two different components, protein and DNA. And the issue is, well, which of these components is actually the component involved with carrying the hereditary traits? Nobody was really clear. And while they started to look at how can you identify which one is the trait element, experiments started to be undertaken using cultured cells and isolating the protein and the DNA components from chromosomes. In fact, it ended up in 1944 where the results were finally apparent. For in that year, Avery, McLeod, and McCarty published research that revealed that when working with two species of bacteria, they could actually change the character of one species by employing the DNA from another species. Essentially, they set up petri dishes of species A and then added to these petri dishes either the protein from chromosomes of species B or the DNA from chromosomes from species B, in an effort to see if one of those two components would carry the traits of species B into the cultures of species A. In the experiments, they found that the proteins from chromosomes of species B did not affect the morphology or development of species A. However, when they took the DNA from those chromosomes of species B and added it to the cultures of species A, the species A bacteria began to transform, expressing traits of species B. It was then that they fully understood that it was the DNA that was carrying the traits from one species to another. They finally found what they were looking for. They knew that the traits were controlled by something physical. They now found that it was the DNA, and that was the component of the chromosomes. And from then on, we started to look very actively, how can DNA do that? And it was interesting because while it was in 1944 that DNA was discovered to carry the traits, it was only 9 years later in 1953 when the understanding of that DNA hit the public. I remember the day myself when that information was published in the scientific journals because it was carried in our newspapers in New York. It was the front page of the tabloid in big block letters that read, "Secret of Life Discovered." And it went on to talk about the work of James Watson and Francis Crick, discoverers of the DNA double helix. Through their work, Watson and Crick found that the hereditary molecule DNA was a two-stranded molecule that was twisted around each other in a spiral. that when they looked at the nature of these molecules, they were found to consist of only four chemical bases or subunits, that these subunits, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, which are abbreviated as A, T, C, and G, were the components that comprised these long linear strands of DNA, that these little sequences of the bases, the A, T, Cs, and Gs, actually provided a code. So there were linear codes along the DNA. The use of the code was to create the proteins of the human body. The proteins are a different class of macromolecules. The proteins are very complex molecules. We now know that the human is comprised of over 100,000 different kinds of proteins. The proteins are very important. The proteins provide for our physical structure, and the proteins also provide for the behaviors that we express, because proteins are unique molecules. Proteins are molecules that are able to move. So not only do they provide for a physical structure, but as the proteins change shape, their movement provides for physiology. It provides for the characters of living systems such as respiration, digestion, excretion, muscle contraction, on and on. All of these behaviors of action are derived from the proteins. So the proteins provide for both our structure and for our behavior. The question, of course, was really important now because while they were looking for the DNA, that physical thing that controlled life, they still had to ask one more important question. What is it that controls the DNA? Well, they really weren't too sure. So in experiments right after the DNA helix was discovered, they found that if they could split the double helix into two parts, into two single helices, and then take each of these single helices and put it into a beaker with subunits, the A, T, and C, and G building blocks of DNA, and just put the single strands into the solution and incubate it, after a short time when they pulled out the DNA, it had returned to a double-stranded DNA. They found that one strand of DNA would actually be a code to create the second strand of DNA. So all of a sudden, they saw an answer and they said, oh my goodness, DNA controls itself. If you take a single strand of DNA and split it into two, each strand would make a complementary copy of itself. Now I'd have two double-stranded DNAs, and each of these strands of DNA could be passed to a daughter cell. So basically it's that DNA possesses codes that program for the complex proteins that provide for our structure and our function. But DNA also has the unique ability to replicate itself. And therefore, DNA appeared to be the end-all in regard to information control in biology. And based on this information, Francis Crick, one of the co-founders of the DNA helix, came up with something called the central dogma. The central dogma is a foundationary pillar under the science of biology. The central dogma reveals this. Information flow in biological systems is a one-way street. It starts with DNA. The DNA is copied into an equivalent of a Xerox version of itself called RNA. That the RNA is the actual physical template upon which proteins are built. So the RNA is the actual blueprint describing the nature and structure of proteins. So basically what this said was the central dogma revealed that while we are indeed protein machines and our behaviors are controlled by our proteins, the character of our proteins and the programming of our proteins comes from the DNA. And basically what we started to recognize that the character of an organism is pre-programmed in its DNA. And that since the DNA makes the proteins and since the proteins provide for the character, that if you wanted to understand the nature of life or control life, you'd really have to get a handle on this DNA. And as a result, a lot of research in molecular genetics started from 1960s to the 1970s, and it gave us more and more information on the nature of how genes control life. It led to a concept called genetic determinism, which says essentially this. At the moment of conception, the genes from the mother and the genes from the father come together in the fertilized egg called a zygote. And in the zygote, the genes are sorted out, and these genes actually become a program, a printout of the future of this organism, because the characters in the genes will be represented as the characters of the proteins in the final living organism. So basically what it said was this, is that our fate, in some way, is absolutely pre-programmed at the moment of conception by the selection of genes that will be activated in our genome. the genome being all of the genes in a single organism. So essentially, the genome biology became the focus of scientists whose mission it was to control and to dominate nature. For an understanding of genes would lead us the ability to change the genes and engineer individual organisms, plants, and animals by changing their traits. And then in that way, we would be able to control and dominate nature. There's only one problem with this hypothesis, and the problem relates to how we, as people in this world, deal with our lives. Because what we're being told by science is that we are actually victims of our heredity, for the simple reason is this. We don't apparently select the genes that we have. We can't really just go change the genes that we have and become something different. So we become what the genes are. And since we didn't pick them and have no control of them, then more or less we're a victim. And that the traits in our lives are sort of pre-told and forecast for us in the genome that we came with. And basically it says as you go through life, then you start to recognize that things may be out of your control. If your mother had cancer and your grandmother had cancer and your aunt had cancer and you're a woman in that family, it appears that maybe you will end up with cancer as well, because these are traits carried by the genes, presumably. That if they're all different kinds of traits, it was even found, for example, that when geneticists were looking at happy people with a question, is there a gene for happiness? Well, sure enough, they split two populations of people into an experiment, happy people and unhappy people. And their focus was, are there genes in the happy people that are active that are not active in the unhappy people? And from that pursuit, of course, they found some genes that appeared to be more active in happy people. And then they came to the conclusion, well, at the moment of birth, the gene that you got covering happiness will determine how much happiness you can even experience in your whole life. This concept of genetic determinization is actually a victimization because, as I mentioned, we apparently had no control over these genes. Well, the problem of victimization and things being out of control is not a big problem for a major industry that obviously profits from this understanding called the pharmaceutical industry. Because the pharmaceutical industry is based on the fact that, listen, you're a victim, you're a machine, you're made out of parts, and if your parts aren't working well, we can manufacture new parts, different parts, and change the operation of the machine. So all of a sudden, we start to recognize not only are we victims of our genes, but there's a way out through pharmaceutical drugs. And today the world is absolutely crazy with drugs controlling everything. Everyday life events that were never really medical conditions are now called medical conditions to sell drugs. And the interesting thing is, it is selling us these drugs because we are believing we are victims of our own machine, that we are out of control of that machine. Well, in 1980, the biologist finally said, through all the molecular genetics research, it appears that the contents of the central dogma, the fact that DNA goes to RNA goes to protein, appears to completely understand and describe the nature of life that we experience here on this planet. And as a result, just like the physicists back in 1893, the biologists got a little bit haughty and said, we know it. We know how life works. Everything is so clear and understandable. All we need now is one last biology project. It'll be the last project, and after that, all of biology will be understood and manipulated. This last biology project is called the Human Genome Project. Its function? To look at all the genes that comprise a human. And the reason for that is if we could make a compendium, a list of genes for every factor and character of human life, then if someone has a problem, we will perhaps be able to genetically engineer them with a new gene that will compensate for that problem, and we would be able to control and dominate their issues. Of course, the mission statement of science was going to be resolved in this final human genome project. Well, now we finally get to that cosmic joke, the one that's unfolding right now. And listen to this because it's a real exciting moment. And it goes like this. Scientists who already knew how life worked through the genes had recognized this, that for every protein in the human body, you need a gene as a blueprint to make that protein. Well, if we have over 100,000 different proteins, it automatically implied that when the Human Genome Project got finished, we'd have at least 100,000 genes, each gene programming one of the protein building blocks of the human biology. Secondarily, there were other genes that they recognized must exist. Genes that don't actually make protein building blocks, but genes that control the activity of other genes. This form of DNA is called regulatory DNA. And they represent genes that don't make product but do make control mechanisms. So basically, they said, okay, there'll be 100,000 plus genes to make products, building blocks, proteins, and then another 20 to 40,000 genes that would be classified as regulatory DNA to control the protein-making genes. Well, they did this project between 1987 when it was founded and in 2001 when the results came in. And I remember those results when they came in, looking forward to them to see what they would find. And the answer is, rather than 120 to 140,000 expected genes, they only found 25,000 genes. And this was a major shock, because according to the mechanism, we needed in excess of 100,000 genes. The issue is, how can you explain for human life, human complexity, the characters of mentation and consciousness, and all of the abilities that we express in our body with only 25,000 genes? Especially when you consider that some of the most primitive organisms on this planet have about the same number of genes. Because before they did the Human Genome Project, they started with other animals that geneticists had been studying. One of those animals is a small little worm that's hardly visible with your eye and has about 1,240 cells. This little organism, with a name longer than the organism, Caenorhabditis elegans, was found in the first human genome experiments, the prototypes that were carried out on this worm, to contain only about 24,000 genes. And all of a sudden, 24,000 genes fell to be the minimum number of genes to make an animal. They then studied the fruit fly, or the Drosophila. Probably you even did genetic studies on them in school. And the issue about this is that, of course, anything about the genome of the Drosophila would be very useful, considering there was 100 years of research on mating these flies and studying their behaviors. So they look forward to looking for the genome of the Drosophila. And as they had already anticipated before the results came in, that as an organism gains complexity, that complexity would be reflected in greater numbers of genes. So while they found 24,000 genes in the Caenorhabditis elegans, they were expecting a lot more genes in the Drosophila. And when the genome project for the Drosophila revealed its results, there were only about 18,000 genes. And all of a sudden, that just threw a big monkey wrench in their thoughts for this reason. How can you make a more complex organism, such as a fruit fly, compared to that little tiny roundworm, the Caenorhabditis elegans, with less genes? It didn't make sense according to the model. And then, of course, when the Human Genome Project came out and found that there were only 25,000 genes, that really shocked them because, my goodness, you can make a whole human with 50 trillion cells and all the characters that come with the human biology. Compared that to the biology of the little Caenorhabditis elegans, that it takes 24,000 genes to make this little worm and only 1,000 more genes to make the human. Of course, everything started to fall apart. And yet, unfortunately, science really wasn't about to go tell the public about this, because the science was very happy to tell the public, the Human Genome Project was totally successful. We found all the genes. Well, that is in fact the truth. They did find all the genes, 25,000 of them. The unfortunate part is, they really haven't said, well, how can you explain biology with over 100,000 genes missing from the model that you require? And this is where, all of a sudden, a new biology comes in. The cosmic joke. They actually thought they knew exactly how life worked, only to find out they were wrong. There were not enough genes to provide for that mechanism that they so believed in. There was actually experiments over 100 years ago that revealed that genes didn't control life. But those experiments were considered to be an aside, an exception to the rule, and they didn't really want to talk about it. And these experiments 100 years ago revealed something very interesting. They found that you could remove the nucleus of a cell. And the fact is, the nucleus was the organelle inside the cell that contained all the genes. As the structure inside the cell, the nucleus as the repository for the DNA, was considered to be the brain of a cell. In fact, many textbooks still refer to the nucleus as the brain of the cell for the simple reason. Since the nucleus contains the genes, and the genes control life, then the nucleus as a repository for all these genes would be the organelle that would control life. It would be the brain. And yet what was interesting in these studies over 100 years ago, they removed the nuclei from cells, a process called enucleation. And what was the big surprise? And that was, after they removed the genes, the cells still lived. Some of them could live for 2 or more months. They just didn't sit there. They ate, they drank, They got rid of waste matter, they moved around, they communicated with other cells, they could avoid toxins, and basically their behaviors were particularly unperturbed by the fact that they had no genes. What you really have to do is stop and ask a question. Well, if you consider the nucleus to be the brain of the cell, then ask a simple question. What is the consequence of taking the brain out of any organism and then throwing it away? And the answer, of course, is death. Immediate death. And yet, when they enucleated these cells, the cells didn't die, as I said. Many of them lasted for 2 months. They then started to die off after some period of time. Well, the initial point is this. Obviously, the nucleus couldn't have been the brain of the cell, because the cells still had a life. They had an integrated, purposeful behavior that they carried out in the absence of genes. So something in the cell must be controlling that cell, but it had to be something other than the genes. Well, the issue is, what is it that controls life? And this is where the revolution begins. Because once we start to look into what controls life, we move away from the belief that we are automatons, biochemical machines controlled by genes, to recognize that we have very profound powers over the unfoldment of our internal biology as well as the experiences in our external world. To get an understanding of the science I'm going to talk about, it is necessary for us to go back to my introduction into advanced research. Well, I got first interested in cells when I was 7 years old and saw cells for the first time in a microscope. I didn't realize that that initial event that mesmerized me would lead me into my career. Years later, I found myself as a graduate student in biology at the University of Virginia. And in 1968, I had the wonderful opportunity of learning how to culture stem cells from my master. His name is Erwin Konigsberg. Erv Konigsberg was the first scientist to create the conditions of cloning stem cells. And this was way back in 1968. I bring that up because today we talk about stem cells as if there's something brand new that just came off the press. And yet I was working on stem cells almost 40 years ago. And it was during those days when Irv was teaching me how to culture these cells that I found my first important lesson that later led to the unfolding of an amazing understanding about cells. This lesson was offered by Irv when I was culturing my first set of cells and was about to put the cells into the incubator. As I was carrying the petri dishes over to the incubator and I was about to put them in, Irv said to me, he said, "Bruce, tomorrow morning when you come in and look at these cells, what I want you to recognize is this. If the cells don't look good, if they don't look healthy, I don't want you to tamper with the cells. I want you to first look at the conditions of the environment." Because over the years, Irv found that it was environmental conditions that seemed to impact the health and fate of the cells in his tissue culture. So I started culturing these cells. And after I finished my PhD and did a postdoc at the University of Texas, I ended up at the University of Wisconsin where I continued my research on cloned human cells and animal cells. And it was there at the university, as I started to carry out experiments on these stem cells, that I started to realize something very interesting about Irv's admonition about the environment influencing cells. Because as I started to change the environment of the cultures, with very specific references to the components in that culture medium and the conditions of the incubator, I started to realize that I greatly influenced the fate of the cells that I was growing. So, for example, in my experiments, I'd start off with a culture of cells and isolate a single cell, a progenitor cell called a myoblast. A myoblast is a stem cell that, when activated, normally provides for muscle. All of us right now have myoblasts in our bodies. I don't care what age you are sitting with these embryonic-like cells interspersed among your muscle tissue. So if you start to exercise a lot and you need to increase your muscle mass, you will actually activate these myoblasts to create a larger population and then contribute to the mass of the muscle that you're exercising. If you damage your muscle, the myoblasts are the stem cells that will actually repair the damage and bring the muscle back into its normal situation. So the interesting thing was that I'm working with these identifiable cells, and I would isolate these cells, put them into cultures by themselves, and from a single cell grow a large colony of cells. All these cells were isogenous, meaning their genes were all exactly the same because they all came from the same parent cell. So these were genetically identical cells. What I found was this. If I take one set of cells and put them into an environment with the standard conditions that I'd been using, of course they form muscle, and the cells actually would form mature muscles that would actually contract in the petri dish. However, if I took cells from the same community, genetically identical cells, and put them into a second environment with different conditions, the cells didn't form muscle, but in fact form bone. And then again, if I took cells from the same original culture and put them into a third petri dish with yet a different set of conditions, these cells would form fat. And at some point I started to realize, while I was teaching medical students at the same time the understanding of the central dogma that genes control life, that DNA goes to RNA goes to protein, and the character of life is controlled and regulated by the DNA, my cells were giving me another insight into the world of life. My cells started to reveal to me that their fate wasn't really determined by their genes, for the fact was all the cells and all the experiments were genetically identical. But the fate of the cells was really more or less connected to the environment, that whatever the environmental conditions are, they were involved with the selection of the genes that ultimately led to the fate of the cells. So the question was, what was really going on in my cultures? As I tried to get my colleagues to understand this work, which was published in a number of different journals, I found that the reception of this work was not very interesting to them, for they were very much preoccupied with tooling up for the concept of the Human Genome Project that was unfolding at that time. That this kind of work that I was involved with was really more or less, it must be an exception, and we really don't have time to deal with your exceptions, Bruce. So they sort of dismissed my work, and yet I realized as a scientist that the work was repeatable, predictable, it's been published, it's been reviewed by my peers, and accepted as a scientific piece of laboratory research. So at some point, I felt I was a little bit out of integrity because I was getting lessons about life from the cells in the tissue culture that did not in any way correspond to the information that I was providing medical students about how life worked. And as a result of that, I found that it was very, very necessary to not be in that environment. And in fact, I actually resigned my tenured position at the university because I found that I was just not in integrity staying there teaching what I knew to be wrong. And so on my own, I started to continue my studies as to what is it that was going on in my culture? What could I learn from these stem cells? What could I find out about how life is controlled by looking at them rather than just falling into the dogma that everyone else was blindly following? So I started to try to look into the character of what actually life is all about. I already had some very basic fundamental information. As I told you, the body, the cells are made out of proteins. 100,000 different kinds of proteins. The proteins are the building blocks that give us our physical structure and give us our behavioral attributes. What's interesting about the proteins is that proteins are linear molecules like threads, and that when the molecule is synthesized, the protein folds up into complex shapes. The final folding shape of a protein is actually a reflection of the balancing of the positive and negative charges along the length of this filament called a protein macromolecule. And so that the protein would fold itself up in such a way as to balance all of the charges and provide a very stable shape. And these shapes were the shapes that gave rise to the structures of the cell, so that they were indeed like physical building blocks, just like bricks building a building. However, as I mentioned, proteins are the unique molecules because proteins can change shape. And when a protein changes shape, the shape change actually reflects movement. The movement created by a protein as it's changing from shape A to shape B, or in actual biochemical terms, as it changes from conformation A to conformation B, the movement that results is actually harnessed by the cell to carry out functions. So the building blocks start to move, and the movement is used to create the characters of physiology. Protein movements provide for digestion. Protein movements provide for respiration. Protein movements provide for muscle contraction. So all of a sudden we start to see how the static building blocks become dynamic, and in their dynamic character create the character of life. It's interesting just to reflect on this very simple fact. A human cadaver looks exactly like a human because it still has all the proteins. It has the structural, physical configuration of a protein machine shaped like a human, but it doesn't express life. And then I'd have to say, so what is life? What is different between the cadaver and a living thing? And the answer is movement. And then all of a sudden we say, yeah, but movement comes from the proteins changing shape. So if you really want to understand the nature of life, then you'd have to ask the question is, what is it that causes a protein to move or change shape? Because if you would understand what that is, then you can start to regulate or control the movement of proteins. Well, it was interesting because in my understanding through biochemistry courses and protein chemistry courses, I was informed already that that what causes a protein to change shape is called a signal. A signal can be a particle. And now that we know that quantum mechanics is the foundation of the universe, we also recognize that particles are actually energy, and that even pure energy waves could be signals. So biology has to recognize that signals, either in the form of physical things such as drugs or hormones or growth factors, can influence proteins. So can signals that are not physical, etheric signals, such as radio waves and light waves and sound waves. All of these forms of energy are also signals. But how does a signal cause a protein to move? And the answer is this. The shape of a protein is finally realized when all the positive and negative charges in the protein are balanced as the protein folds in such a way to neutralize all of its charges. However, when a protein folds up, it actually looks like a little wire sculpture. Imagine that first you start with a long straight strip of wire, but by folding it and kinking it and looping it, you can actually create a three-dimensional structure. Well, proteins are the equivalent of wire structure, the wire being the long protein backbone. But the wire will fold itself into particular shapes based on how it can balance its positive and negative charges. When doing so, we get a three-dimensional protein, a wire sculpture, so to speak. These sculptured proteins frequently have little pockets or clefts or little parts on their surface that can plug into things in our world, other chemicals, other atoms, other elements, so that, imagine this, the protein could act like a baseball glove. It can be shaped just like a baseball glove, and in the pocket, a ball can fit in. The ball would be tantamount to a signal. So imagine that we have a protein that folds itself up into the shape of a baseball glove. And that's the protein. I said, well, what's the signal that can influence it? And the answer is, what chemical will have the precise shape of the baseball and the charge distribution that will allow that baseball to plug into the pocket in that glove? So I look at the protein as the baseball glove and the signal as the baseball. And in this particular case, the signal has a charge to it. So while the baseball glove is the conformation that is stable for that particular protein, as soon as the baseball enters the glove, the charges are altered because the baseball is bringing its own charges with it. In the face of the new charges, the protein wire, the backbone of the protein, the peptide, changes its shape to accommodate the new charges and then looks for a second shape that now is more stable when the baseball is present. So essentially what it says is this, the baseball glove, the protein, has a conformation A. But when the baseball fits into the pocket of the glove, it causes the charges to change, and the protein rewraps itself into a different shape. Now we call that conformation B. But the critical part about this is the movement that occurs as the protein is changing from shape A to shape B. Because if you can use that movement to drive work, then you can create functions. So, for example, let's consider the baseball glove protein to be a digestive enzyme and the baseball to be a particle of food. As the baseball enters into the glove, it causes the protein to change shape. As the protein changes shape, it breaks the baseball, and then you express digestion. And so basically, the shape changes of a protein can be used to do something like break the baseball down into building blocks, and that would be a digestion process. The other possibility is that I can put a bunch of pieces in the glove, and then it changes shape and squeezes the pieces together and actually creates something. So digestion and synthesis actually represent the same kind of process, but going in opposite directions. And yet what we're really looking at is digestion is an active process. How did it occur? The movement of the glove. Yeah, but the glove is protein. Why did the protein move? And the answer is because the food molecule acted as a signal that forced the protein to change its backbone. And in that changing process, the action is converted into the process of digestion. As a result of that, we start to recognize, yes, there's an action involved with proteins. It's the action that animates life. And when you look at the human body with over 100,000 different proteins, all these different actions of each different protein collectively integrated into a giant machine represents what the human body is all about. That the proteins of our body are programmed by the nature of the genes that we have. But here's an interesting point. Well, the gene acts as a blueprint, and I can build a protein using the blueprint of the gene. The protein doesn't express any life, and the gene doesn't cause it to have a life. The gene only provides a blueprint to make the protein. The life that we observed, the movement of the protein, wasn't controlled by the protein. It was influenced by the signal. And all of a sudden you say, well, wait, what does this really represent? It says, well, there's two parts to life. The physical part.